I just had to write down a few notes so I didn't miss anything, but it is my pleasure to introduce five new writers who I've had the privilege of working with over the last few months in UCC's new MA in Creative Writing. Being in a workshop with these writers has been an education for myself, most of all, being witness to new, innovative, exciting poems, taking example from their courage to dedicate this year to writing, to reading, and to working on their craft and the effectiveness of their poems has been the most stimulating part of this process for me. I won't call them new writers, because most of them have been writing for several years, but part of their courage has been allowing to think of yourselves, I suppose, as writers, to call yourselves writers for this year, and I suppose being aware that it is a process, but to, you know, stand up and say, I am a writer. And some of them will be new to you tonight. The steady, sturdy community of Cork writers, and I'd ask you to join me in welcoming Michelle, Louise, Niamh, Kathleen and Bridget. No one ever thinks of the nerves of the person who has to introduce the nervous reader. So we'll get started. We'll start with Michelle McAdoo. Michelle is a native of Ballincollig in County Cork and still lives there with her husband Paul and three little boys. Michelle is a primary school teacher and is currently studying for her MA in Creative Writing at UCC. Her interests include reading, running and of course writing. Thank you, Michelle.
My thanks for allowing us the opportunity to read your piece tonight. Leanne said, my name is Michelle McAdoo, I'm from Ballincollig, and I'm a mother, wife, teacher, and for tonight anyway, at least I'm a poet as well. I'll get started straight away. Some of the poems that I'm going to share with you tonight are very new pieces of work, kind of worked on over the period we were studying with Leanne. So some of them are older poems I revisited during that period, and others are new emerging poems. So I'll start away. The first one I'm going to read is called Canal Moor, Late March. So my husband is from the Bear Peninsula, and we often visit, and his father is a sheep farmer. So we visited last March, and one of my little boys saw lambs just born for the first time. This poem is just about newness and having that experience, that very first experience, and you never have that again. Okay, Canal Moor, Late March. Heaving, I follow him into the gloom. Fish boxes and old ropes litter the yard, while inside the smell is putrid new life. Twin velvety crowns bleating noisily. Hesitant at their cries, he lags behind until his curiosity shakes him, and he pats their squirming heads and giggles at unfamiliar sounds in the darkness. A whiskey bottle is grabbed from a shelf. First, Grandad's practiced hand, and then he, bright-eyed, takes charge, surprised and amused at the creature's inconceivable tongues, sucking and tugging on his offering. He turns his face up to me and smiles. The next one I'm going to read is Rooks, and really it's just wanted to capture something that happens around our house every year, and every time it happens it just surprises me. Rooks come and gather around our houses, and the houses near us, and they just gather in a huge squall, and the noise and the chatter is just unbelievable, and it just always surprises me every year that they arrive in this very urban setting, and they just seem so primal and raw. So that's what I was trying to capture in this poem, Rooks. That autumn, they punctured the evening sky like hysterical dervishes, spilling onto the rooftops and chimney pots, searching for fields long eaten by stone. Winter scattered them, that black cassocked throng, and they were driven away by snow and ice and frozen barren ground while I remained inside. In spring, they found the gaps, they squeezed through keyholes, down chimney breaths, flew in an open door on a laundry day to fill the tiny spaces. It was summer when they unwrapped their raven cloak from around me and swooped skyward in a noisy squall. In the end, I just moved out of their cloud shell. And the next poem is called The Woodshed. The windows are panes of dust, shielding us from the sight of children's bicycles hung from the roof, and a floor littered with football boots among discarded tools. Chisels, knives, blades, a dust mask and the lathe, idle in the corner, a half-turned bowl of spotted beech clamped in its silent jaws. Outside, storm-felled chestnut and hazel, which you gathered in the dark nights of the new year, wait, in disordered piles against the door, for you, to open the lock and work, until shavings, like discarded words, pile up at your feet. Finally, this poem is called Summer's End, and it's important to me. It was one of the first poems, one of the first exercises we did in the MA class with Leanne. She asked us to write a poem, 13 ways of looking at her, and we had to choose an animal. So a wasp presented himself to me anyway, so I decided to write about the wasp inside, and he was actually inside in a jam jar in one of my colleagues' classrooms. The children were all studying him, so I started writing about him. So I got 13 verses out of him, which thankfully there's not 13 verses yet. So I kept going at the poem, and I suppose what came out of it was just a poem about the end of a time of a bumblebee. So this is called Summer's End. The tiny upturned belly of a wasp lies in a jam jar. There is a graveyard in the classroom window swollen with summer's remains. Stiff, brittle bodies, winged and lifeless in a hardening heat. In the sickly sweet scent of orchards and thick violet ditches, bulging with sunlight-soured fruit, there is poison. And a wasp knows the stories of the summer. He guards them in the black and yellow burden of his body. He is rising in the lavender.
Louise was born in Cork and lives near Blarney. She's been writing for several years, and she was educated in UCC and is currently completing the MA in Creative Writing. So.
Hi everyone, it's my first time here, so thanks for giving us the opportunity to be here. I have a few poems, and some of them, like Michelle said, are very new, just from a few workshops, but I'll start anyway. The first one's called Keepsake, and I wrote it after thinking about a little permanent calendar that my grandmother has, and she's used it for years. I never remember her not having it, and she's still using it even though she's 92 now. So, Keepsake. Of all the keepsakes she might have taken, it was the datekeeper that she chose. A little tin trinket with an oval face that sat on a rectangular base and swiveled on its hinges to display the new day's date, a permanent calendar. It must have been its familiarity that appealed. She had used it faithfully for years, each morning winding it forward, bringing yesterday into today. So it came with her when she moved from her home to a place where her living might be more assisted. It sits at her bedside alongside her boar bristle brush and the photos of a life since lived and only partially recalled. She long ago spliced out the heart's gold. Every day she winds it on, still keeping the date, as the days, like spent memories, keep slipping by. The second poem is very recent. We had to prepare a portfolio for poetry just recently, and I was struggling with what to prepare for us. And so this one emerged. I just grabbed my pencil. So, pencil. My pencil has been pared away, shaved down to a nub, its point made dull over and over until it could take no more sharpening. What did I spend its lead on? Largely on scribbles, I think. I suppose it led me to wherever I was going, filled pages with tracings of my scattered logic, the catalogue of my slow crawl towards the words that could hold the weight of whichever mystery was then demanding meaning. Now it's just a novelty, a keepsake on my desk, an inch-long piece of wood with a silver band gripping the grey, flaky tip of its eraser. I can't bear to throw it out, so I keep it with childish pride, a satisfied reminder of all my past labours, the effort it takes to try and locate myself on a page, the endless paring away of layers until you finally reach the point. I've replaced it now with a stapler in 3H bound in the bottom drawer, though I do wonder if this new pencil's grade. It's not as clear, as bold, or as vivid on the page. I sit here by the window, and when the cloud breaks to let the light stream in, this new lead seems to fade, becoming silvery and veiled, and I have to tilt the page to make the words come clear. This is called Linoleum, and it's kind of about, I suppose, the house that my father grew up in Wicklow, where we used to go on weekends and holidays and summertime, and it went on the market when my grandmother died, and it's just been empty for about 10 years now, just wasn't sold. So Leanne was kind of encouraging us to write from different perspectives, so it was the Linoleum that came out. Sliced by the father's Stanley knife and laid the length of the sloping hall in a thrown-up house warped with crooked walls. Time-worn, dingy from years of softening the family's footfall, faded taupe was replaced with fawn. Rolled out, measured and glued down, lino adhering to lino, filling the same faults and depressions, travelling the same uneven slant as before. Three layers deep now, in a house gone quiet. First steps of footsteps, either grown or dead or gone. So I have one more, it's called Journey Home. And it's, I suppose, just someone making her way home at the end of the day, feeling a bit battered after the day, a bit sorry for herself. Journey home. A rainy late afternoon in the city, traipsing towards home, day done. You go along thinking yourself capable until the day's dealings deal you otherwise. Some casual cruelty, conscious or not, slices through you, renders you skinless, raw and hollow, like some transparent half-life wandering about the gulf between you and those inscrutables who seem to function so well. That's everyone else, by the way, managing life. You think it'll always be this way. They'll always be cruel, and always you will feel it, like a slow-moving scalpel over your flesh. It's both your fragility and their malice. You're like a scared rabbit in a rat's nest, and the city's the worst place to be upset. The jarring noise is the resounding of your unrest. Your vulnerability is only heightened in the crowd. It's as though some protective membrane has just now burst, reduced you to a bare nerve. You're firing disquiet with an audible report. Your distress is plainly evident. You'll start crying soon, or at least begin distilling tears for the quiet vacuum of the car. The clamour rises as the bus fumes past. You step onto the road, a horn blasts.
I'm going to introduce Kathleen next. and you're going to have to imagine that I'm one of Kathleen's sons, because this bio was written by your son. Kathleen O'Brien is a ghostwriter of poetry in a dusty attic, which is due to be demolished soon. She is a woman who has led parallel lives, a saint of a mother. Are you sure you didn't write this? A paragon of a wife, a known addict of philosophy, an unrepentant time waster who would rather read a book than do housework. I myself bought her the dishwasher as a present so that we could eat off clean plates. Welcome, Kathy.
For this opportunity. The first poem is called Glengarry Wood. In the spring I walk in Glengarry Woods, scooping in my hands the ice cold water, as if I only exist somewhere else, to walk in the shadow of a wood. In a place of rushing water, I feel like a wolf searching a sea of green between the purple haze of rhododendron. I bask in the haunted light, in wonder of where the river goes. Did I dream the smell of wood smoke in the need to be here? Or is my mouth filled with ash like a winter fire burns low? If I close my eyes, you're standing on the bridge above the waterfall, but there's spray on my face, thinking about water under bridges, and my shadow falls behind. This one is about thinking about Van Gogh. I've always loved Van Gogh, and I think poetry is 50% pain and 50% pleasure. And this is about thinking about Van Gogh. He hears wave music beating in his head as he is standing in an icy room with hunger gnawing in his belly. He paints great lunging waves in the silent company of a chair and a bed. Soon those waves will creep inland, flow across wheat fields that run uphill to where the mountains are waiting, and the yellow rays of his sun will fill the whole sky. Soon his dream will transform a grey room with a brutal gas jet into a starry night in a blazing cobalt blue, wavering between glowing stars. And they say his vision of life is warped. Soon he's in an all-white hospital where he climbs out of bed in the morning and walks to a window, and he paints a sea of waving golden corn until finally only his bed and a chair. I'll have to introduce this one because it's a typical creative writing class where you're given triggers without a gun. And you're asked to actually write about, so I was asked to write about a poem about a girl at evening, a bicycle, and there's a goat in there somewhere. And I go home and I'm living on a farm and we've cows calving and I'm thinking of a girl, a bicycle, a goat, and a few more F words as well. And eventually I wrote this at the last minute and I called it The Poem I Didn't Write. In creative writing class, you said you wanted a poem about a girl at evening, a bicycle, and there's a goat in there somewhere. But it's a cold grey January dawn, and our first baby calf arrived last night, 2 weeks premature. He'd been lying for hours in frozen farmyard muck when we found him and pulled the mucus from his throat. He says, "Ma," when he sees me, and he thinks I'm his mother. Right now, I'm trying to feed him with a baby bottle. a few drops at a time. He says, "Ma," again, when I crouch down, and he pushes his head against my hand. His eyes blink like he knows me, and he likes saying my name. The rusty bicycle is blocking a gap. The girl is feeding a calf. What do I know about the goat? You must know what goats are like. Their dream of following the grass out of reach, like creative writers. It's dusk when a twig snaps, and he's circling around me with his colourless eyes. I know by the set of his jaw that he's still dreaming.
Thanks. My last one. It's called Dream. Sometimes you know more about your family, your parents, from a dream than maybe when they're young, especially when they die when you're young. In a dream, she meets her father and knows him by the twist and turn of a spade. His worn out hand is an old rope in the wind's fist as he digs for turf in a tidal bog. In the dead of night, she sees again how two heads curve together in a man and horse shadow. She thinks she hears a harness singing to the soft face of moon. But smoky clouds are drifting from the sea, up the Strand Road, and he slowly begins to fade. His eyes are washed out blue against the thunder of the tide.
Prior, it's from Kinsale. Her work has been published on Poetry 24, Revival and the Stinging Fly, and has been performed at Kinsale Arts Week and the Sarah Festival. Please welcome me.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here. Thinking my brother was the first one was about him. Our family boat was stolen when we were kids, so my brother decided to fix the problem himself, called the maiden voyage. My brother spent weeks in the garage, gathering offcuts of wood, banging, sawing, assembling a Frankenstein of a boat. When the frame was solid, he pulled old curtains taut over it, nailed them in place, then took boxes of misshapen candles, melted them over her hull, dinner table red, white, green, until a thick waxen skin, the colour of seaweed, covered her. When high tide swelled, it was time. He picked me, the littlest one. We lowered her onto the water. She received us, water lapping at her sides. He placed the oars in the oarlocks, turned her towards the island, began to row, and I felt like I was leaving the earth. Halfway there, her gunwales were getting lower and lower. I scooped water with a baler made from half a plastic milk bottle. The boat was filling faster. "One of us will have to get out," he said, looking at me. I slid gently overboard. I didn't mind the cold or the swim to shore, but walking up the crowded slipway hurt. Walking up the crowded slipway in sodden cords and t-shirt hurt, and watching her flounder. The next hot day, her skin sagged and melted all around her, where she lay, between the fiberglass boats at the beach. This next one is setting off till. it's a gift poem. A man giving a gift to a woman. "Here, take this record. Tilt it, tip it from its sleeve like a dress unzipped. Then gently slip off the delicate, translucent inner sleeve. Keep it safe from scratches.
away from naked flames, and it will faithfully play our music just the same every time. Years from now, when I am gone, and you sit up alone at night, let it play right through. Then, drop the needle at the start again. You will hear me in the crackling silence between movements. So that goat that Kathleen was referring to earlier that should have been in the poem, I managed to get the goats in time. I have no bicycles or whatever. I miss those the most. So yeah, this is my goat poem. It's called Kidnapped. All of Sandy Cove watches through binoculars, the men on the island rounding up wild goats. They parked their hi-ace at the slip, used Bill Masser's boat. The goats scramble for their lives, hooves clacking against fiberglass, accustomed only to rocks and grass as wild as they are. One splashes overboard, makes a swim for it. Barry Fitzsimon's request to please leave the goats alone gets lost crossing the water. Betty Hogan calls the guards. The sky is navy as their uniforms by the time the squad car arrives. A white rectangle speeds away, leaving two goats behind. They clatter out the cliff road, stop at a gap in the gorse, and look across at the rest of the herd on their island home. This is my last one then. For this, you're going to have to imagine, as I often do, that I'm a rock star. And you're the photographer. It's called Kim Gordon with Gun. Sure, I'll pose for you. I'll hold your rifle for you and look at you that way. I'll wear jeans and cowgirl boots and lean against a battered pickup truck. I'm not showing so much as an ankle, and I keep my breasts under a baggy black t-shirt. I know you've smutted me. You need those props. Without them, I'm just a girl who keeps her clothes on for photos. No red lipstick, no smouldering cigarette dangling, half-open mouth. Instead of undressing me, you grained me black and white and dressed me up, a subtle kind of sex. You think I don't know that. You better hope this gun's not loaded. Go on, you shoot first. Finally, Bridget. Bridget Sprowls was born in New Jersey and now lives in Cork. Her poems and stories have appeared in Steps magazine, Scribner Creative Review, Casino, The Red Wheelbarrow Poets Anthology, and the McGill Daily. Bridget has been a music reviewer for the Times Square magazine. This past year, her fiction was broadcast on CKUT Radio Montreal and shortlisted for the Atlantic Writing Prize. Bridget. I'm very happy to be here. I'll start with a poem that kind of came from an ongoing debate about why moths fly into flames and into lights. It's called Brother. You, at 11, beat a bully's head against our street. Restive at 22, you whirled around in your sex moon. At 31, and mind far gone, you lay scorched on the sill, twitching. All my life, you flit through twofold silence, frantic as the evening moth, handsome as the dawn.
We had a poem about rooks tonight, and I actually don't mind them so much, or their relatives. This poem is called Jackdaw. In the torn evening, joggers and pensioners move around. I watch your yellow eyes, two distant tiny beads. That wing is all wrong. Like a sash, it crooks around your breast. A girl with her hair yanked back decides not to see, and you throw your body, ruined though it is, to one side. Will those friends of yours not flap down, and if not croak the rights, then nod as you nod? Who made them so callously wise as not to roost this night with you on the wet sod, tempting foxes? I imagine first light, a rustling of leaves slung into a pile, your small heat underneath escaping. We are like the figurines on the brick mantelpiece, their sleek, pinked faces flaunting how to get along. Ceramic passion hollow, but gilt with antique grace, we learn from genuflections, gold buckles, blaze, until our fingers taper into glinting bloodless tines, and clinks become the sound of business-like embrace. I kiss your ear, a piece falls down the sink. You slap my rear, your hand falls off. But drink, we find a decent glue. It keeps my nose in place and dulls the whistle through our chinks. Our better selves remain quite safe in honored rows above the hearth. We are their grotesque devotees, too crippled by devotedness. This one's about the forest that covers most of the largest country in the world. It's called taiga. The globe shakes, and there you lie in snow, your eyes winged with ice, and blue guttering lips full of smoke. And I have cracked my teeth on chattering sips, and flung our trinkets into groaning lakes, and followed hints of wood smoke whilst blind in a squall, and hummed peculiar strains to muffle familiar ache, and all to find you in this place where toes and hands are chewed of hearts, and yours grown black I clamp in caves. And
thank you so much. I just want to thank you, the audience, thank Paul and O'Bale for this space tonight, and thank the writers who read here tonight. Would you mind giving them